Well, what can I say about Dr. Jeff Seif? There's too much to say. I'll be up here taking up all of his time. So I'll just give a brief highlights. I've known Jeff, God, it's got to be over 25 years now. I've known Jeff 25 years. Jeff is a graduate of Moody Bible Institute. He has both his master's and his PhD from SMU in theology. He is the head of Zoe 11 Ministries, which, by the way, is at 30 years and running, is one of the longest-running television shows in history, including all secular television as well. But not just Dr. Seif, but the new head of Zoe 11 Ministries. Jeff is a prolific author. He's written over 25 books. In the last year or two alone, he's written 4 books on the Iranian menace, on Rabbi Saul of Tarsus, on Women by Divine Design, and my personal favorite, Guns and Moses. Jeff is the chairman of the Jewish Studies Department at CFNI. He also, for many, many years, had his own. He was the lead pastor of his own kehillah. He, in addition to all of these things, he also is an active police officer. He's a graduate of the North Texas Regional Police Academy. He's a certified police instructor. He holds both a reserve and an active commission in the police force. He's also a former chaplain of the police department, so watch out. Don't know if he's packing today or not, but he's here with his lovely wife, Patty, with his sister, Lisa. He has 2 sons. Jacob is here today with us, and Zach is not. But please join me in welcoming Jeff. But in addition to all these things, and J.D. will be personally pleased to know, that in addition to all that, that Patty and Jeff are also expert ballroom dancers. So join me in welcoming Dr. Jeff Seif.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's so good to see you, and it is so good to be here. I leaned over and told Patty we heard Elizabeth there on the violin. Beautiful old friends reconnecting. It's just wonderful. And let's just give it up for that bat mitzvah one more time, I'm telling you. I think that Miriam did such a stellar job of exploring Lashon Hara, an evil tongue, and its various implications. And it's great to have a big sister, Elisheva, shielding her from all those bullets, all these projectiles coming her way. And speaking of big sisters, I'm so thrilled. My sister Lisa, as David has mentioned, is here, who's not the least bit familiar with Messianic Jewish experience. And so if she was leaning over and we were talking, I was explaining. Because is this the first time, or one of the first times anyways, that Lisa's ever evolved her way into a Messianic Jewish world? So let's give it up for my sister, please. And I want to compare notes with the bat mitzvah girl to see if you're getting a better deal out of your big sister than I got out of mine. I want to know that. Speaking of big and little, as David mentioned, I'm so thrilled that my son Jacob is here, my wife Patty, Zachary couldn't be here. Rabbi David asked me to consider Bible prophecy this morning. And so what I want to do is do just that. If you're interested, we have various books on the subject, various television programs that we've done. Most recently, I was in Turkey, Greece, and Italy. We did a 12-part series, 12 30-minute programs. It's the equivalent of 3 full-length motion pictures, and it's entitled In the Footsteps of the Rabbi from Tarsus, where we're exploring Rav Shaul's. We're looking at his movements, and we're looking at his parchments. And that series starts airing on national television this coming week. I am on my way in a few weeks to Israel again to film a series on Ezekiel. It's going to be an 8-part series. And Ezekiel is a fascinating prophet. Do you know that both Daniel and Ezekiel spoke from what would be Iraq and Iran today? They weren't Israel-based prophets. And it's striking to me anyway that speaking from that part of the world It's those Hebrew prophets more than other prophets that are talking about the end of the world. What I want to do is explore, having done a series recently on Daniel, I want to go and have a look at Ezekiel. What I want to have a look at this morning, however, is I want to look at what I'm calling the Bible's end game. So what I want to do is look at what we call the revelation. And I want to look at the last few moments in the revelation. And what I want to impose upon your mind's eye is the understanding that what's happening in Revelation is only discernible if it's refracted through a mosaic prism. That is, you have to know Moses to understand John. I've long wondered at one level why the book Revelation is called Revelation, because it's so very unrevealing at one level. Arguably, what's happening in that book is about as clear as mud. Some of you might have heard of Hermann Rorschach, who was a Danish psychiatrist who developed a test called the Rorschach test. This is the inkblot test, where you go to the shrink and sit down, and doc says, well, what do you see when you look at this? Well, looks like a butterfly. Thank you. Then shows another panel. What does this look like? It looks like a cave. What it is it's an interesting test. It's called a projective analysis test. The person thinks that they're describing what they're seeing on the page. But what quickly becomes true is the individual is saying more about what's in them than what's on the page itself. And the ink blot is just a means to elicit the perspectives that resonate within the viewer. In much the same way, Revelation, with all of its symbolism, all of its allegory, different interpreters enter into the world of the literature, and it seems to me at the end of the day, where the lion's share of the expositors wind up saying more about what they believe, necessarily, than what the text is actually saying. This morning, I'm going to posit, that is, I'm going to formally put forth that the principal hermeneutic key that opens up the revelation, particularly at the very end, the key to the door is found in the Torah. Whether that's so, whether you agree with me, you'll have to see as you follow me. In any case, what I'd like to do is begin in Revelation, and I want to begin in what was the Torah portion for today in Revelation. What do I mean by that? If you will, please go to the 16th chapter. What you're going to see here is the beginning of the end in the biblical drama. And what's very discernible is that various plagues are unleashed upon planet Earth. In chapter 16, verse 2, there's sores. In verses 3 through 7, waters are turned to blood. In verses 8 and 9, there's scorching heat. In 10 and 11, there's darkness. Now, I want you to think for a minute. Never mind the kind of troubles that hit Earth at the very end. And we see this in the literature. And then it culminates with the Euphrates River drying up and these hordes coming into the region for this climactic battle called Armageddon. There are these various punishments on Earth, various plagues that hit it, culminating finally then in the waters parting and then this army coming into the region. And this event later on precipitates the Mashiach coming back on a white horse. It's the actual end game. And then there's this clash of titanic forces, with the net result then that this Mashiach takes this serpent and throws this serpent into a pit, in the wake of which then you have paradise restored. There's this new kingdom. There's this kingdom comes down out of heaven. There's this tree of life, there's waters of healing, etc. Now, what's interesting for my money, if one looks at the different stories that are interwoven into the tapestry of the endgame, The storyline that's employed in the end of the Bible is the same storyline that existed in the beginning. For example, this morning, the Torah portion, if one steps back and looks at the reading as we find ourselves in the book of Shemot, in the book of Exodus, we have the burning bush experience, in the wake of which then Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, goes to Paro Melech Mitzrayim. He goes to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and says, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, why don't you go take a long walk on a short pier? Get out of my world. And if you can recall the judgment and the deliverance, what happens is Moshe is used to strike the earth with scorches, with fire, with blood. And it finally culminates. You have these plagues. Don Sephardei Akinim Orab Debeshachin Orab Arbechoshech Machas Bechoros. Blood, frogs, lice, this and that. And finally, there's the slaying of the firstborn, and this precipitates then the story, you know it, the children of Israel make their way out of Egypt, and there's a great miracle. What happens is the waters part. And what happens is the children of Israel get out of Dodge. Now what's striking, if you look at the redemption story in the beginning of the literature, if one looks at the book Shemot, Exodus, therein there's a story of judgments upon the earth, blood, boils, darkness. And then finally the great miracle, you know, the parting of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel go through. What's interesting, if you look, never mind at the beginning story, never mind protology, in theological nomenclature, there are things that are referred to as eschatological, that is, referring to the end, and then there are things that are protological, that is, referring to the beginning. But when you enter into the Jesus, the Yeshua narrative, there's someone who says, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. There's some kind of collapsing. There's some kind of bridge building between the two. In any case, if you'll look with me, please, first in the 16th chapter of the Revelation, there's these punishments that are spilled out on planet Earth. In verse 2, there's this bowl upon the earth of loathsome sores that come upon individuals that receive the mark of the beast. These sores. If one goes back to the 10 plagues, there's boils, there's sores that agitate those in Egypt. The next plague again, verses 4 through 7, you have the seas and the rivers turn to blood. There's this striking story in the Exodus account, how, you know, when Moshe talks to the Lord, hey, you know, you want me to go talk to Pharaoh? I'm some desert rat, you know, how's he going to listen to me? I am going to be with you. There are going to be signs. And you can recall early on there, the sign was he took it, and the Nile, which was the center of Egyptian economy, this is bested. It turns to blood, and it's foul, and it wreaks havoc in industry, and it becomes something of a sign of Jehovah God's triumph over the deities, philosophies, and powers in Egypt proper. Inasmuch as you have the waters turned to blood in the Exodus narrative, so too here in the Johannine telling, John himself being the revelator, therein you have the rivers and springs in verse 4 become blood. In verse 3, the sea becomes blood. In verse 8, then you have people scorched. Their sun is so very hot, and power was given to scorch men with fire. And if you can recall the Exodus narrative, when hail came down, the literature says there was fire in the hail. It's like raining fire down. Not like, it's not tacit, it's explicit that fire was rained down on the Egyptians. Maybe it's just some cosmic coincidence. You have, in verses 10 and 11, you have choshech. You have darkness. What happens is the earth, in effect, goes blind. And then, You have the story that spooks us all in verse 12. This angel poured out his bowl on the river Euphrates. Its water was dried up, so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. In 13, these spirits then drive this army amassed on the other side of the Euphrates, and they make their way into a region. And this then, in verse 15, precipitates the first speaking part that Yeshua gets in the whole play. We haven't heard boo from the boss since in the beginning of the story, there's a messenger that gives word to various congregations. And after that, mums the word. Then you have those words of exhortation giving. And then the world in the Revelation text spirals into decay, despair, disorientation. Described in different ways in different days are people experiencing disequilibrium. And things just go down to a nadir, to a very, very low point, culminating finally, according to the text here. What happens is there's a war, there's a bad moon rising. You know, the word evil is the word live spelled backwards. You know, the word devil is the word lived spelled backwards. There's a story here. What eats out of the pages at the ragged edge of time after the earth is struck with these judgments. Finally, the author says that there was a force that was amassed just east of the Euphrates. And what happens is the waters dry up, and then these armies come forth. And they're driven, according to the language of the text, they're driven in verse 14 by spirits of demons. And then in verse 15, here's where one hears from Yeshua, where one hears from Jesus, in what's understood as the revelation of Jesus. Finally, he speaks. We haven't heard from him in chapters and chapters and chapters. And this event with the Euphrates then precipitates verse 15, "Behold, I am coming as a thief." That is, when people don't expect. My police career, a lot of it was done at night. I have caught more than one thief. And they come when people don't expect. Yeshua says, "I come as a thief. Better stay up. Wake up and smell the coffee." And then after that in verse 16, quote, "And they gathered them together to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon." Now let's camp on this for a moment. Regroup, focus, and advance. I put forth that if someone looks at the Bible's end game, it's principally only discernible by understanding its first game. If you look at this major redemption story at the end of the book, to me, I see vestiges of the redemption story in the beginning of the book. And the only way to really know it is to begin to look at the end of the good news through the eyes of the Jews. And for this we have Torah talk. For me, all I want to do initially is observe with you that when one looks at the literature, one sees plagues that smite the earth. And the redemption story, with a different nuance, is precipitated by a river drying up and then people coming from the river. I've heard that story before, and so have you. But it's nuanced differently. Interestingly, for my money, in the Exodus narrative, what happens is the Red Sea parts and the children of Israel go through it. and it's their salvation. It's like the good guys pass through the waters and the bad guys are drowned. In this story here, however, by way of contradistinction, the waters part and the bad guys go through the story. They go through the water. Y'all with me here? To me, the similarity in language is striking, but it's not just that alone. There's a war. There's a great conflagration that's played out. Never mind the various nuances of it. To me, I think it's striking, for my money anyway. If one looks at the Revelation narrative, there's trouble coming from just across the Euphrates River. There's forces there that, according to the text, are driven by devils, and they make their way into the region, and they're going to clash. They come forth for a battle called Armageddon. Maybe it's just one big cosmic coincidence. Pray tell, if today you would look at a map, never mind the rabbi and his rap, if you would just look at a map, any map, and put the question to the map, pray tell, what country so happens to be just due east of the Euphrates River? Inquiring minds want to know, you would come upon the sovereign nation state, the Islamic Republic of Iran, who in more than one way, on more than one day, its leader, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, has sworn on a stack of Korans that the world is a better place without Israel. Hellbent is he on a world without Zion, and mobilizing whatever friends that he can have in the region that'll get behind him with that particular endeavor. Now, maybe it's one big cosmic coincidence. One looks over at that part of the world, one has Iraq. Iraq today, something of a black hole in space. It just absorbs what's ever near it. It destroys politicians' careers. It gobbles up billions of dollars. And you have, you know, secretaries of state and politicians running around to solve the Mideast crisis. A crisis that's been around before the players were ever born. When I read the biblical narrative, there was a fella, Abraham, destined to be the father of a nation. Ha'am Godol, a great nation. But his wife says, honey, listen, I'm not doing so good, to tell you the truth, in the nation-producing business. Listen to me. Take Hagar. What you want to do is you're going to have a child through her, and well, the child will be born, and I'll just kind of be the mother. You know, listen to me. Some ideas sound better on paper than the way they really work out in reality. Point number one. Point number two, gentlemen, it's not always good to listen to your wife. Now, well, I get pelted. So I'm glad you spent your candidate on the bat mitzvah girl. You know, that's a dangerous statement. In any case, what happens here is these women, what happens is Hagar is going to give birth to Ishmael, who's going to be the father of Arab peoples. Finally, then Sarah is going to become pregnant. He comes home, he says, listen to me there, God has spoken and you're going to become pregnant. She laughs. She says, honey, listen to me, I've been on Social Security now for 25 years. You know, I have a mother-in-law, 79 years old. I wouldn't expect to come for the holidays. And mother says, Jeffrey, and she starts giggling. Yeah, how you doing, Mom? Good to see you. Well, Mom, what's so funny? Hey, listen, I want you to know that I'm pregnant. I mean, you expect there's seasons of life, and that ain't it. What happens is, you know, that it's striking in the literature. You have, before the kids are born, the women can't stand each other. Cat fight going there. You know, between Hagar, who's going to give birth to Ishmael, and there's that line. And then there's Sarah, who's going to give birth to Yitzchak, to Isaac, in that line. These women are at it. to me, it's striking that so much of what is being played out in the world today has its roots in yesterday. And it's principally discernible through Torah talk. Now, I know many in the church, well, that's the Old Testament. You know, they got the Jew book, we got the new book, and that's for them, and this is for us, and we're just going to go happy-clappy into the future, and that stuff doesn't matter anymore. Well, okay, you know, I think if I took off my glasses, I wouldn't see as clearly as I would when I put them on. And I think in much the same way, Torah provides a lens that not only guides moral conduct, but it also provides crispness in vision to discern the biblical text. We observe, if you follow with me in the Revelation story, that the redemption drama seems to be unfolding in a manner that's very congruent with the Exodus drama. I want you to look at the, not so much what the prelude to the war, but after the war in Armageddon. I want you to look in your Bibles, please, to the book Revelation, the 22nd chapter. I'm looking at the very end. Now listen, when I was in the police academy, I learned this as a patrol cop years in it. Listen, if you're going to paper up someone, if you're going to, you need to have what's called probable cause to effect an arrest, or I'd have a supervisor that would kick it back. Now what you need is you need specific and articulable facts that would lead a reasonable person to believe that a particular crime has been committed and a particular person has been responsible for it. Or else the DA won't take the case. We'll never send it up. Kick it back. You need to have facts. I would suggest to you, when you look at the end game in the New Testament, that there are specific and articulable facts that would lead you to believe that the only way that you can discern the end game is to look at the first game. For example, if you look in Revelation chapter 22, where all is well, I want you to look with me for a moment at paradise. And I want you to see how paradise is described using imagery from the book Bereshit, from Genesis. If you look here in verse 1, the 22nd chapter, he showed me a river of the water of life. It's in Gan Eden, it's in paradise, the Garden of Eden, where there are these rivers. And here, paradise restored, there's this river of life. In verse 2, there by the side of the river is the tree of life. Now that's a name that ought to resonate in a place like this, particularly because of the name is Etz Chaim. By the way, I love those t-shirts. My sister Lisa said, Lisa doesn't know nothing from Messianic Jewish experience. She's just visiting me from Indiana. But when she saw those bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah t-shirts that said high five, she says, I definitely got to get me one of them. Life, Etz Chaim. Even the, not only is it the name of the congregation, but there's the tree of life in the Revelation. But even the tree of life itself is principally imagery that's borrowed from the paradise narrative in the book Genesis, where we'll look at it in a moment. There's a river of life, and there's this tree of life. Well, here in Paradise Restored, there's a river of life, there's a tree of life that's bearing fruits, each yielding its fruit every month. And if you look in verse 3, there shall be no more curse there, but the throne of God and the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. They shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads. There shall be no night there. They need no lamp or light of sun, for the Lord God gives them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. There's this vision of paradise restored. And the language of this vision of a new heaven coming down and all of that, the place where, I mean, I think if you and I are gut level honest, I know if I'm honest, you know, I mean, my life is not perfect to the point where there's not stuff that bugs me. you know, we'll stay up night, you know, we got to think about the bills and the relationships and the stuff at work and the challenges. And I mean, we all have that stuff. And even walking with the Lord in a good life, there's ways that the good life could be better. And sometimes, whether it's our own bodies, whether it's our circumstances, there's stuff that just needs fixed. And we sure could use a little help from heaven for Earth's vexing dilemmas, for Earth's knotty problems. And the knot is ultimately untied here in the Revelation story, where he says that there they are, they're in paradise. And even in the word paradise itself comes from a Latin word meaning enclosed garden. And this itself even harks back to the Genesis narrative. What happens is you can recall that they were in paradise. And then they were enticed away. Sin made its entrance onto the stage of the human drama. Adam and Eve bit the apple. The race was vitiated. It was defiled. And they were expunged. They were kicked out. Paradise they were in. Paradise was lost. Well, here, if you look at the endgame text, you not only have literature that harks back to the Exodus narrative, the plagues, the parting of the seas, and all that stuff that just resonates with Mosaic talk. You not only have that, but likewise in the Revelation story at the end game, there's language, there's literature, there's imagery that harks back to the Genesis narrative. Having considered it in the 22nd chapter, I want you to rewind the tape now. Never mind eschatology, go to protology. If you will, look with me, please, in the very beginning of the story. And it's in conjunction with this, friends, that I've got a story to tell. Like you wouldn't believe such a story. I want you to hear me, but first, I want you to see this. If you look in chapter 2, this is the Gan Eden text. You have Genesis 1, Bereshit bara Elohim hashamayim v'et haaretz. In the beginning, God creates the heavens and the earth. Vayhi erev, vayhi boker, yom echad. It was evening, it was morning, day one, day two, day three. Finally, the making is made. The doing is done. Vayiklu hashamayim v'aretz v'kol tziva'om vayikal Elohim ayom hashvi'i. Malachto asher asah. Chapter 2, verse 1 and on, you know, he's worked, he's rested, everybody gets a day off, even the boss, and that's that. After we finish the creation story and the rest story, bingo, then, yes, then, we're in Eden in verse 8. The Lord God planted a garden. Where's this garden? East in Eden. And he put the man whom he had formed. You know, he put the man, the word Adam, the Hebrew word, not for dust, which is afar, or eretz, land, but the word for earthy substance is the word Adama in Hebrew, the earth, Adama. So what does he do? God takes the dirt from the Adama and he fashions this creature. And he says, well, what should we call this? Adama. What should we call this dirt? We'll just call him Adam. Now, guys, we come from dirt, and we were named after dirt. At one level, that's not very flattering. You know, if there's a complaint box in heaven, you know, you get up there, listen, okay, well, I might make a note of that. In any case, here Adam is placed in Eden. And out of the ground, we're told in verse 9, the Lord God made every tree grow that's pleasant to the sight. The tree of life was also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And in verse 10, a river went out of Eden to water the garden. Now what you see, and it's all that I want to accomplish at this juncture, is to note, when you look at the protological section, when you look at the beginning of the story, tree of life, river of life, garden, paradise, felicity, peace, security there. What's interesting in describing paradise restored in the Revelation text, Tree of life, water of life, paradise there. The point is, we're declaring the end in a way that we declare the beginning. You all with me here? Now, there's something that I believe here to be the case, and that is congruity. I want you to note, going back to the, first here, we're in Genesis, in the third chapter, there's this hissing creature. What happens according to this language, some say mythological, say what you want, what you have here, there's this serpent that bests the creation. You know, your problems and your downfall will come to you subtly. Psst, hey, it's a whisper in the ear. How about a drink? How about a cheat? How about an affair? How about this? Psst, you want this. You deserve this. And sometimes the more troubles you have, the more we're inclined to look for something to make it go away. Make the bad thoughts stop. I'll have a drink. I'll have this. No, it comes at you subtly. It doesn't come at you like a freight train. You just get out of the way. Psst, hey, psst. Now what happens when you look in the literature? Psst, hey, psst. Wouldn't you look good in that? Don't you want that? You know, you should have that. You can get that. It's all good. The man said he can't have it. What does he know? You can take it. No one's looking. Psst. Now, it comes subtly in the form of a serpent. And what happens is, with that serpent, then sin makes its entrance onto the stage of the human drama. According to the text, the Lord shows up, you know, boom, boom, boom. Hey, what's going on here? And all of a sudden, you have people acting a little neurotic. You know, you have, you know, God looks at Adam. He says, so what's up with this? What did you do? He says, hey, babe, don't look at me. The woman, she made me do it. Well, miss, what do you have to say? It was the snake. Now, what's interesting about original sin is that in conjunction with it, you note that no one takes responsibility for it. Listen, I've had people up against the wall as a cop before, and I'd say, just be honest with me. I can't promise you. I mean, but there is this thing called discretion. You know, and if someone's honest, it makes the adversarial process melt a little bit. Person's being a little real, a little honest. What you find here in the Genesis narrative is they're busted. And the Lord shows up. And what it is they're playing games. They're blaming. Well, it's his fault. It's their fault. It's this, that. And the snake just kind of slithers away. One of the things that's clear in the literature, beyond the fact that human beings are never going to heal up unless they own up. And yeah, by the way, I'm talking about you. Not those other people that aren't in church on Saturday and Sunday or Messianic. I don't care whether you say Yeshua or Jesus. I don't care whether you do Shabbat or you think Shabbat's yesterday's news and it's all about freedom from the law and it's all about Jesus. I mean, listen, I don't care how you cut the cake. That it's incumbent upon individuals to be honest. And what happens here, you look at these, and they're not disposed to go that way. And the net result is God says, Zygazunt, you know, go out of my presence. Now, I said all that to say this. When you look in the Genesis narrative, there's this serpent that defiles. And real quick, back to Revelation, and then I'm putting my landing gear down. Can't keep you here all day. I want you to look in Revelation chapter 20. After the great conflict. And as you're turning there, remember principally what I'm endeavoring to do this morning is just to underscore the fact that you can't understand the end game apart from working with the images from the first game. Whether it's the book Bereshit, Genesis. Bereshit, I know it sounds like I'm cussing in here, but that's just what it is in Hebrew, Bereshit. Whether it's the Genesis narrative or the Exodus narrative, major storyline. To me, it's fascinating. This is the stuff of the end is the language of the beginning. I want you to look in chapter 20. The language is very fanciful. I saw an angel coming down from heaven, This is after the Armageddon conflict, by the way, in the preceding chapter. He laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him. The imagery here of the conquest over evil is reflected in the image of getting a hold of the serpent and binding it and throwing it away. Now, I've done that before. I know that God created animal control to respond to calls. Hey, mister, there's a skunk in my garage, there's a snake in my kitchen or whatever. But what happens is when people call 911, dispatchers have known to be a little confused every now and again. I've taken more than one animal call. I hate snakes. I remember early on in a career as a field training officer, I'm dispatched a lady. This is scary stuff. It's about midnight. And this lady comes home and she has her baby and there's the bassinet upstairs and she goes upstairs and she pulls the blanket down to put the baby in the bassinet, and lo and behold, there was a snake in there. Now, of course, a cop. I'll make it sound like it was a python, you know, by the time we get back to the station and, you know, you kind of beat your chest, probably a little garter snake. I'm not telling you which. But I can tell you it wasn't there when I got there. But I remember thinking, I looked at my FTO and I says, you know, I really hate snakes. But, in the course of a career on more than one occasion, I've had to go grab snakes and kill snakes and absolutely hate them. There's a story here, and if you look in the Revelation text, the 20th chapter, we're told the Lord takes hold of this serpent, who is the devil, and he takes him and he binds him. Now, what's interesting, and it's all I want to develop on this point, and that is whether it's the triumph over evil and wickedness on planet Earth is reflected by getting hold of this ancient serpent of old, the devil. I mean, the language is pushing you back to the Genesis narrative. When you look at the restoration of paradise after that, it's pushing us back to the Genesis narrative. When we look at the world at war and troubles on planet Earth, in advance of this ultimate redemption, it's pushing us back to the Exodus narrative. All that said, I believe that Christians particularly would do well to not be so neurotic about the Torah. I mean, because what happens is it's better to be at peace with the literature and let it serve as a guide to help us come to terms with the story rather than forever be bent on creating distance from it. Y'all with me here? My closing point, and I'd like to close on a point that to me, I think is really striking. And this is where Seif thinks. What I've endeavored to do is spend all of my time just going back and forth in the Bible. And, nothing doesn't take a PhD from Oxford to do that. Just, hey, look at this stuff here in Revelation. Look at this stuff in Genesis. Look at this stuff. I mean, you don't need a PhD in Old Testament and New Testament. Sometimes what you need are advanced degrees to obscure the story. Because it's really simple. The Bible tells its own story. And we do well, those of us in the teaching ministry business, would do well to sit back and just help tease out the story that's already there instead of trying to impose a story. God is finished with the Jew story. God is finished with the Torah story. This story, that story, whatever it is that we want to impose that says more about us than it does about the story itself. In any case, what I've endeavored to do so far is just back and forth, and say, isn't that interesting? But if you'll permit, you know, I think it's more than just coincidence. When I look at the world today and see evil coming from a particular part of the world, I think evil is at work through Islam. I don't believe. I believe that all men and all women are created equal. I don't believe that all philosophical systems are equal, however. I believe that you'll know them by their fruits, not that you'll know them by their toots. I'm interested in what's manifest by the system, not just what its advocates want to say. The advocates want to say Islam's a religion of peace. That's right, we'll take a piece of Israel, a piece of Pakistan, a piece of this, a piece out of her, and a piece out of him. It's a religion of peace. Oh, now, rabbi or reverend or officer or whatever you think you are, you shouldn't criticize other people's religion. Says who? What kind of demon in hell ever said that we should just shut up and be real nice? Oh, no, if you're going to be a religious teacher, then you have to be nice and respectful to everyone all the time. You tell that to the guy who took a whip of cords and whoosh, drove him out of the place because they made it a house of trade. You tell that to the guy who said, you brood of vipers and hypocrites. You make people twice as much the child of hell as you are yourself. You tell it to him that conversation that's biblical in nature ought to be laced with sugar and spice and everything nice. I think that we do well to be honest and sometimes just confront the realities of the world that we live in. And the last time I checked, there's 22 Islamic nations on earth, most of whom are at war with each other, killing each other. How do you blame the Jews on that? Now listen to me, you'll have an Iran-Iraq war, they'll kill a million of each other. Page 32 of the New York Times. At the same time, some Israeli soldier shoots a rubber bullet at someone throwing a Molotov cocktail at him. That's, you know, page 2 of the New York Times. Look at those aggressive Jews. Last I checked, if you look at Israel today, it has more hospitals per capita than any country in the world. It has more museums per capita than any country in the world. This is a commitment to life, to love, to learning, to existing, to breathing, to being. You're looking at a country that has more master's degrees per population than any country in the world. This reflects a love of learning and life. If you look at the gross national product of Israel, what's produced in that country, it's greater than the gross national product of all the countries round about it combined. That reflects a commitment to commerce, to industry, to sechel, to smarts, to hard work. And what you have around it is a culture. In a world where in Islamic culture they're killing each other left and right, right at this time Jews are working on our 159th Nobel Prize. If you look at populations, what percentage? Some 23% of the population of the world are individuals of Islamic extract. Maybe 0.23% of the population of the world, a fraction of 1% of the population of the world are individuals of Jewish extract. But if you look at commitments, enhancement to art, architecture, literature, science, commerce and industry, it's so much from the Jews, and by way of contradistinction, if you look at anger and rage and the unleashing of untold miseries, more times than not, it comes from individuals that say there is no God but Allah and that Muhammad is his prophet. Well, that's not politically correct to say. When I look at the literature, when I look at the end game in the biblical text, trouble comes from there. Wars are mobilized. And in Revelation chapter 16, readers are told that the Armageddon conflict is driven by demons. We're told that these demons, these spirits, drive. They mobilize energies to war, and they come against the Jews and Israel, and it culminates in a place called Armageddon. I believe, and I'm saying this in conclusion, and having said in conclusion, let me say, I've closed my Bible, and that I believe that when a rabbi, a reverend, whatever says conclusion, he better dang well conclude. Because I believe there ain't nothing worse than a preacher who says an in conclusion and you discover he has not concluded. Or he says, and finally, and then you realize that boy ain't serious. What's the old saying? I love a finished speaker. I really, truly do. I don't mean one who's polished. I just mean one who's through. Here's what I want to say to you in conclusion, beyond thanks for having me here. I want to thank you too, those of you that support our ministry. I know a number of you do. You can watch us on television. If you're interested in books, I didn't bring anything to sell. I don't like to use preaching opportunities as point of sale opportunities. I know that would increase the income, but I'd rather get equity with you rather than get money from you. If you're interested, there's stuff in the foyer back there for newsletters. If you're interested, my wife will be back there, and I'll be around here after the service. A point that I want to leave with you is that, number one, I believe that we live in really interesting times, number one. Number two, what I want to leave with you is I think that we're on to something really interesting in these times. That is to explore what it is to look at Yeshua, Jesus, from a Jewish perspective. What does that mean intellectually? What does that mean communally in terms of individuals that are bit with that bug? And even the bit with the bug of things Jewish from a Christian perspective, you might think that's just you in this house here that probably needs to get replaced with a bigger house at some point down the road. I'm not trying to push people to do things, but do the math. Look around. You know, and besides, the building is cracking under the weight. I notice here all the walls and everything. I got a letter yesterday from Denver Seminary. We're starting a Jewish studies program and wondering, Dr. Seif, if you'd serve on the adjunct faculty. Remember years ago, Jack Hafer took me out. He said, listen, I'm starting a seminary on the West Coast. We want to do Jewish studies. It's surprising, a Fuller Theological Seminary, a Jewish studies program, Talbot School of Theology, an Evangelical School, Jewish studies program on the East Coast. All over the place, in Dallas, Texas, Criswell College has a Jewish studies program. You can get an MA or Master's Degree of Divinity from a Baptist seminary in Jewish studies, but not to be outdone by Criswell College. Good friend of mine, Marty Waldman, met with the provost, the assistant provost at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, Fort Worth, largest Protestant theological school in the world. Said, listen, we're looking at developing a Jewish studies program. You know, at different levels, different people are cueing into the fact that we need to get a different view of Jesus. And this is discernible through looking at Jesus through a Jewish lens. Inasmuch as I think perhaps, and I'm no prophet, but the Iowa caucuses remind me that maybe the culture is saying we just don't want to look at things through the traditional Clinton dynasties. We want new ideas and new people. That, you know, Huckabee kind of coming out of nowhere instead of the entrenched Republican tradition. And, you have these people coming out of nowhere that seem to hold the day. Whether that plays out as the story unfolds through the year, I don't know. But it reflects anyway, at least initially, I'm thinking, people are relishing some new ideas. Listen to me, when it comes to looking at things theologically, we have new ideas. We don't tell any new story, we just tell a story that's been long since forgotten. That is exploring Yeshua Jesus from a Jewish perspective. Last I looked, Jesus was a Jew, the disciples were Jews, the story took place in Judea. Paul the Apostle, the principal advocate for so-called Christian faith and practice, was himself an Orthodox Jewish man who came to faith, and he lived as an Orthodox Jew. He wasn't a converted Jew, he was a converted sinner, and it was never a sin to be a Jew. Well, people like me and you, we're exploring what that is. Friends, in conclusion, we live in interesting times, we're on to some interesting ideas, and blessings to you as together we go through life to explore what it all means. Rabbi, thank you so much for having me here today. God bless you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.